For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, Lord, just thank you for this group of faithful folks that have made it out for one more workshop. I just pray that I could be clear. Thanks for your word, too. Thanks that it's clear that you have spoken in the Bible. It's evident in places like the book of Daniel. And I pray that if anything, we would walk out of here more deeply convinced that this is true, God. Amen. All right, I'm a pacer, and I don't have a clicker. So I'm not sure how I'm going to handle that. I also left my lecture notes in the other room, so let me go get those. Hold on a second. All right. Hard to get through this without your notes. So we're going to be looking at Daniel's visions. You're probably familiar with the book of Daniel and the cool stories like Daniel in the lion's den, maybe if you've watched the Veggie Tales or something like that. Well, one thing people don't often know is that there are a series of visions in the book of Daniel in chapter 2, 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, and then in chapter 11 and 12. And if you kind of pull back and look at those visions side by side and see how they parallel and build on each other, you can actually build what I would call a prophetic framework, a timeline that gives us kind of the broad sweep of God's plan and history from the time of Daniel all the way up till the end of history. One way to think about this is if you've done a puzzle, right, what's the first thing you do when you're working on a puzzle? What do? You make the border, right? You hunt around for the edge pieces and the corner pieces just so you can frame the picture. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're just going to try to frame. I'm not going to get every detail. We're just going to try to build that frame around God's vision for the future. That's what we're shooting for. Now, a couple quick things. I'm going to just assume that Daniel was written by a guy named Daniel. Back in 536 B.C., there is some controversy about the date. I've given you a bibliography. The book by Archer, A Survey of Old Testament Introduction, does a great job defending the earlier date of 536 B.C. That's all I'm going to say about it. Secondly, this book, because it's filled with predictions that come true, is meant to tell you a simple message, and that is God's in control. That he's not surprised by, you know, different events that happen in history. Think about who he's writing to. Daniel's writing to Jews who've been ripped out of their homeland, and they've been put in exile. And these Jews have had their temple destroyed, their lives turned upside down, their kings, you know, blinded. And if there's anything they need to know right now is even though things are terrible, their God is still in control. And that's the whole thrust, that's the main theme of the book of Daniel. Now, as we get into these prophecies, two errors to watch out for. One would be to just blow this off and omit studying prophetic details. This is Brian McLaren. He's an emergent writer. And his attitude toward prophecy here is typical of a lot of evangelicals who dismiss detailed prophecy. He says, I see biblical prophecy in terms of warnings and promises, which are different from prognostications. That's a prediction. He doesn't really see predictions so much in there. He says, if I had to put a name on my eschatology, his study of the end times, I suppose I would call it participatory, meaning that God invites us to participate in God's ongoing work in the world, leading to the ultimate victory of all that's good and the ultimate defeat of evil. Beyond that, so anything more than that, he says, there's a lot of eschatological details I was much sure about 20 years ago when I read the Bible less and popular end times books more. You know, what's he implying? His implication is just don't bother with the details. And I'll tell you, you go to a lot of places, a lot of pastors will want to backpedal from the details. And I think it's a mistake. I mean, there are hundreds of prophecies. A quarter of the Bible is prophecy. Lots of details. Are we just going to say that's all window dressing, right? And just sweep it aside like it's garnish on a salad or something? Why would Jesus say, look, I want you to recognize the signs of my coming? You know, take note. When you see this, then you'll know. Why would he use language like that if we weren't supposed to pay attention to prophetic details in the Bible, right? And so that's why we are going to take a good look at a lot of details. Now, the opposite error would be assuming you've got every detail figured out. And boy, Christians have really embarrassed the name of Christ by doing this. There was one guy, Edgar Wisenant, he wrote a book called 88 Reasons Why Jesus is Coming Back in 1988. Oops, you know, I guess that's got to be out of print at this point. And, I mean, you think about the Y2K hysteria that Christians got swept up in, just all the whack job, end times, overconfident, and totally false assertions that so-called Bible interpreters have made, just makes us look silly. It's inoculating the church from ever even looking at prophecy so that when Jesus does come back, they'll probably be asleep. If I was Satan, I'd be overjoyed, right? And so both of these errors are really bad. We're going to get into detail, but I'll try to let you know when I feel like I'm speculating, just as we go through. All right, now Daniel 2. I've given you every passage I think you should look at if you really want to dive into this on your own. I'm not going to cover all of them, but I've just put them here so you have them. Now, in Daniel 2, King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, has a dream, and it flips him out so bad that he can't sleep. He's just, you know, he's kind of undone by the whole experience. And back then, ancient kings would correlate the dreams they had with any major events that followed that dream. So if I'm King Nebuchadnezzar and I dream about drowning, and then a week or two later there's a military invasion, I record that in a dream book. I have my wise men do it. And they do this for centuries so that kings can consult their wise men who read these dream books and go, oh, you had indigestion, or you had this episode. Well, that corresponds to this actual event. Get ready. Okay, and so that's what's happening in the beginning of Daniel 2. Nebuchadnezzar's like, I had this amazing dream. I need to know what it means. The only guy he can find that has the courage to tell him what his dream was and what it means is Daniel. And as we pick up, I'm jumping ahead here. I'm going to skip the first few passages, and I'm just going to look at verse 28. The first thing Daniel says is he tells King Nebuchadnezzar, there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He's made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. Okay, this phrase, if you study the Old Testament, it's just a general reference to the future. The latter days could be a near-term event, something, you know, centuries down the road, or it could even refer to the end of history. But all Daniel is telling him is, Nebuchadnezzar, what you're about to hear pertains to things that follow you. And as we see, what we're going to see is this dream that he spins out doesn't just follow him in the short term, but it really kind of blocks out major events for the rest of human history. Okay, so here's the actual dream. He says, this was your dream. This is at the end of verse 28. And the visions that were in your mind on your bed. As for you, O king, when you were on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. You, O king, were looking. This is going to be kind of tricky to do. Slide this over here. You, O king, were looking. And behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of gold, its breast and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out. This is a really weird image, but imagine this flying stone cut without hands, striking the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushing them. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time. You know, the whole superstructure of the statue just collapses as this stone hits it. And it becomes like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind blows it away, so that not a trace of it was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So a statue with four component parts, a head of gold, a chest and arms of silver, a belly and thighs of bronze, feet of iron and, legs of iron and feet and toes of iron and clay. So you get these four basic parts of the statue. We're going to find out they represent human kingdoms. Then this stone flies in and just obliterates it, just terminates all of those kingdoms, that whole human enterprise, brings it to an end. Okay, and so that's what the vision was. Here's the interpretation. Daniel says, that's the dream. Now we'll tell you the interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he's given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over all of them. You are the head of gold. So there's no confusion here. The head of the statue is Babylon. It's not just King Nebuchadnezzar. It's the kingdom he represents, right? And notice he says, after you. And so they're not kingdoms that coexist, but one is displacing the other in time. And so after this first kingdom, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over the earth. Then there'll be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, as much as iron crushes and shatters all things, so that like iron that breaks in pieces, it'll crush and break all these in pieces, and that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. It'll be a divided kingdom, but it'll have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. Now just notice right real quick, he says like one sentence about the chest and arms and one sentence about the belly and thighs. But then when he gets to the fourth kingdom, it's like all this detail. You know, iron legs are, you know, this powerful kingdom, these toes. He gets into the toes big time. They're like made out of pottery and iron, so some is strong and brittle. In that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they'll combine with one another in the seed of men, but won't adhere to one another, even as iron doesn't combine with pottery. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom won't be left for another people. It'll itself endure forever, inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. There it is again. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. Okay, now those are details. That's a ton of detail. And just to make sense of this detail, I made this pretty little chart on the top of the next page, on page 2. He's saying this is a succession of kingdoms that correspond to different parts of the statue. In chapter 2, the only kingdom he identifies is Babylon. He just says the next kingdom is inferior to it and follows it. Then he says there's a third kingdom, doesn't say anything about it. And then he really geeks out on the fourth kingdom. And he emphasizes that there's the legs of iron that's powerful, crushing and shattering. But then he talks about the mixed composition toes, and he says that they're kings. He refers to them as kings in verse 44. So, and we also get the sense that they all occur at the same time, like a confederacy of kings. And this has made a lot of interpreters feel like there may be two phases here, the fourth kingdom itself that's like iron, and then this ten-toed confederacy of kings that has kind of a different composition. The thing that's important to note, too, is whatever you think about all that, it's all obliterated by the stone that becomes a mountain. Actually, it happens in the days of those kings. God's kingdom comes in and wipes them out. And so I'm going to argue, and I'm going to support this all through this talk. The first kingdom is Babylon. That's been proven. The The second one's Medo-Persia. The third kingdom's Greece, and that the fourth kingdom refers to Rome. Okay? And I realize that might seem like a stretch, and it is a stretch because we're in chapter 2. We got the rest of the book to do. So you'll have to keep this plate spinning. By the end of this talk, I think you'll be persuaded this is exactly correct. A couple observations. It is significant that the order of these empires I've given you is the actual order in history. Medo-Persia replaced Babylon, Greece replaced Medo-Persia, Rome displaced Greece as the dominant world power. So that's the way it went down in history. So that makes my right column attractive. Secondly, if you actually do look at these chapters side by side, I think the identification is much stronger, especially for Medo-Persia and Greece. Rome is never named in the book of Daniel, not once. But it is clearly referred to in chapter 11 as the fourth kingdom. And you'll see that when we get to chapter 11. This idea also, just the language that this fourth kingdom has legs of iron that crush and destroy. It's fitting. It's fitting of Rome. I don't think we can put too much on that, but that's something to consider as well. Now, here's a couple questions we have to ask. This kingdom, this stone that flies in and destroys the statue, have we seen it already? I mean, think about what Jesus said when he came. He said, the kingdom is at hand. And people were able to enter the kingdom as they put their trust in him. And so some people would say, some theologians would say, the kingdom has come. It's already come. Jesus announced it. I don't think that's possible, though. If I'm reading this right, the arrival of this kingdom means the end of all human authority and kingdoms before it. We haven't seen that yet. Long after Jesus rose from the dead and ascended the Father, you know, the Roman Empire continued, and many other empires have risen and fallen since. So the idea that this kingdom, this stone that destroys the statue, already came when Jesus came, nah. Actually, Jesus himself said, and I don't know if I have this verse in here or not. I don't think I do. You're going to have to, oh yeah, I do. The disciples were really curious. They're like, so what's going to happen? Is Israel going to be restored to power? Is Messiah going to reign from Jerusalem? Jesus says, well, they ask him, is it at this time that you're restoring the kingdom to Israel? He said, it's not for you to know the times or epochs which the Father has fixed by his own authority. What's he implying? He's like, it's coming, but I'm not going to give you the start date. You don't get to know that. It was really clear, Jesus was really clear, though, I am coming back to judge the righteous and the wicked. I am coming back to set up my kingdom and come as a king. And so it's that latter kingdom, you know, when Jesus establishes his rule on earth, that's the rock that smashes the statue. We have not seen that yet. Okay, another question to ask is just look at this. This is kind of troubling. Okay, there's the sequence of kingdoms. And if I've got this right, Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, and Rome, how is this possible that this is actually the Rome of history if it's terminated in the days of those kings, if it's wiped out by the arrival of God's kingdom? You see that as a problem? We haven't seen God's kingdom yet, and yet Rome fell a long time ago. Both halves gone. So how can we say, in what sense is this the Rome of history? How can that fourth kingdom be Rome if God's kingdom hasn't come? And so, yeah, that's the thing that I'm going to also try to get at here. And the answer I'm going to give, and I know it'll sound like a stretch, and again, I'll defend it as we go, is that perhaps the fourth kingdom has these two phases. The Rome of ancient history, symbolized by the legs of iron, and then a latter kingdom, a 10-king confederacy, symbolized by the toes of mixed composition, right? Maybe that's what happens. Of course, to make this work, there's going to have to be a gap in time in here between these two phases of the fourth kingdom, right? This kingdom, these kings are terminated by the arrival of God's kingdom. So this kingdom, for this to work, would have to appear near the end of history. So we really need to be looking for language in these visions that supports the idea that there's two phases, and language that really does imply a gap in time exists. Okay, so let's see as we go through this if that's what we find. See where it says, for now, consider this? I'm going to skip that section. That's just for you. Now the timeline. Look at that timeline. So what I'm saying, the model I'm working with is there's Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, a gap in time, then a revitalized or a somehow related version of Rome, and then the arrival of God's kingdom to blow it all away and establish God's rule. That's the picture I'm going to work with. Now, let's go to chapter 5 and go to work on the second, third, and fourth kingdoms. Let's try to tighten up those identifications. So in chapter 5 of Daniel, Babylon falls. It falls. It's actually the last, if you read chapter 5, it describes the last night of the Babylonian Empire. Now remember in Daniel 2, Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, he says, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to you. And it would be useful to know, what kingdom was that? Well, the night that Babylon fell, this king, Belshazzar, was having a drunken party in his palace. And during this party, he sees a disembodied hand writing a cryptic message on the wall. And Daniel interprets that message for him, and this is what it says. It says, you, Belshazzar, have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. That's the Babylonian king at the time. And your kingdom has been divided and given over to who? To the Medes and Persians. Okay, so what was the kingdom that displaced Babylon? According to Daniel, it was the Medes and Persians. And notice he talks about them as one entity. I'm going to call them the Medo-Persians, but I'm not making this up. So when we look at the second row under the header, and we say that the second kingdom is Medo-Persia, it's because Daniel 5 clearly states they were the empire that displaced or came after Babylon. That's what chapter 5 says. Now, jumping up to chapter 7, there's another. So there you go. Yeah, the Medo-Persian Empire is the second kingdom after Babylon. When you get into chapter 7, this time Daniel himself has a dream. He says, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. Have you guys ever seen Pacific Rim? You got these giant, like, monsters fighting giant robots, coming up out of the water with, you know, foam and water dripping off them, just striding toward the shore. I think it was something like that. These four beasts parading, you know, one after the other, coming up from the sea, he says. And what I'm going to do, I just thought this would be helpful. Daniel 7 is divided between the vision itself and the interpretation of the vision. So I'm just going to jump back and forth. Here's the vision, here's what it means, here's the vision, here's what it means. Okay, so let's start out. In verse 15, Daniel said, I was kind of flipped out about that dream. These visions were alarming me. And so he walks up to a bystander. It's probably an angel. So this is in his dream. He sees a bystander, and he walks up and says, what is the meaning of all this? And the bystander told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. He says, these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever, for all ages to come. Now that ought to strike you as very similar to Daniel 2, a vision about four kingdoms then terminated by the arrival of God's eternal kingdom. Very similar to Daniel 2. That's exactly what we just read over there. Now let's get into this kingdom by kingdom. The first kingdom is a clear reference to Babylon. Every scholar, every commentary you could find would agree. It says the first was like a lion, this first beast. It had wings of an eagle. It kept looking until its wings were plucked. And it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. So check it out. Its wings were plucked. That's a sign of humiliation. But then later, it was stood back up on its 2 feet and given a mind. If you've read Daniel, you know exactly who that's about. It's about the humbling and restoration of Nebuchadnezzar. Read it in Daniel 4. It's an unmistakable reference to Babylon. And that's significant because we're anchoring the first kingdom right into that same sequence that we saw in chapter 2. It begins with Babylon. So the next kingdom would certainly be Medo-Persia. And I think you'll see as we go that fits. There's other things I could say, like the symbolism of a lion. Man, that's all over the Old Testament. Babylon's described as a lion. The Ishtar Gate at Babylon, you know, with blue and yellow glazed brick. It's like lions everywhere. This was their national symbol. It's a perfect image of Babylon. Okay, then there's this weird lopsided bear. Behold another beast, the second one resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. That's weird, a lopsided bear. It follows Babylon, so I would argue that it's Medo-Persia, and it has this weird feature that one side of it is more prominent or larger, I don't know, like kind of distorted and bigger. Yeah, and some of these little references, like there were 3 ribs in its mouth. Some folks would argue, well, it was a conquest of 3 different countries. There were 3 main military conquests that Medo-Persia had. I'm not going to get into which ones they are, but it does. If you get into the historical details, even some of these other images fit Medo-Persia really well. Then you get into the third beast. I left it out, didn't I? Oh, gosh. Hey, I need somebody to read chapter 7, verse 6. Unless I have it hidden here somewhere. Yeah, how about somebody read chapter 7, verse 6? Whoever's got a Bible, if you just read that, that'd be awesome. I don't have one in front of me.
After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on his back.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the third animal is a leopard with four wings, a flying leopard, 4 wings, 4 heads. Real emphasis on the number 4. That's Greece. Now, I realize that's not much to go on, but when we get into chapter 8, you'll be persuaded that imagery, that emphasis on 4 is clearly pointing to Greece. And again, Greece is the empire that followed Medo-Persia in history. Okay, now, just like we saw in chapter 2, he spends a lot of time on the fourth kingdom. He says, after this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. That's interesting. So that iron and trampling, just like that overwhelming power, same type of thing here. It was different from all the other beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating those horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. Okay, so what a bizarre image. He sees this fourth beast. He doesn't say Laika, or, you know, it was like nothing he'd ever seen. I don't know if you've ever read Where the Wild Things Are. Maybe a beast like that, you know, just some kind of conglomeration of stuff. Dreadful and terrifying. And notice that there's the beast itself, and then there's these 10 horns. That kind of evokes the idea of the 10 toes in chapter 2, right? There's this kingdom, and then there's these 10 horns. Horns, by the way, are a symbol of power or authority. And as we read the interpretation of the vision, it'll turn out those 10 horns are 10 kings. And so let's do that. Let's read the interpretation of this. Daniel says, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful with its teeth of iron, claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and the meaning of the ten horns. Notice how he really breaks them out. I wanted to know about that beast, and I wanted to know about the ten horns. Like, he sees that as kind of a distinct thing that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which is larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn, he's really zeroing in on this little horn. It was waging war with the saints, with God's people, and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days, that's a term for God, till the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So here's God's kingdom coming in. Thus he said, the fourth beast, and listen to this language, this is important, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms. It'll devour the whole earth, tread it down, and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, right, out of that fourth kingdom will arise, he says, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise. And then another one will arise after, that's the little horn. He'll be different from the previous ones and will subdue the three kings. So we've got the kingdom, and then we've got these kings coming out of it. That's where this concept of two phases comes from. I'm not just making this up, that's really the way this reads. Right? So this little horn, this king, will subdue three of those ten kings, and he'll speak out against the Most High. So he'll speak out against God. He'll wear down God's people, the saints of the highest one. He's going to make alterations in the times and law. So he'll do something to disrupt their religious practices. That's probably what that's a reference to. And they'll be given into his hands. That's an ominous statement. God's people will be given into the hands of this malevolent, God-hating, God's people-hating ruler. For, he says, a time, times, and half a time. A lot we could get into, but let's just look at our handy-dandy chart again. Okay, got the chart on the bottom of page 4. Just to make sure we don't miss the main point. So there's the fourth beast, a fourth kingdom following the third. And then there's the ten horns that grow out of the head of the fourth beast. It seems like they coexist at the same time because that little horn comes up among them, which that implies they were all there at the same time, right? And then as far as the little horn himself, he's not one of the ten. He comes up among them. He's a king. That's what it says in verse 24. He speaks against the Most High God. He wages war with God's people. And actually, God's people are kind of at his mercy for a while, and he kind of disrupts the way they do their religion. This guy sounds really evil. And we'll get into who he is and whatnot in a bit. But that's Daniel 7. If you flip the page, I just gave you some text here. You can, that first part, let's just skip the text. I think the chart's what we want to get to. See Daniel 2 compared to Daniel 7. See that chart? So just so you don't lose me, the head of gold in chapter 2 is the winged lion in chapter 7. The chest and arms of silver is the bear raised up on one side. The belly and thighs of bronze is the leopard with four wings and four heads. I'm saying both symbols of Greece. And again, look how we have legs of iron in Daniel 2 and this terrible strong beast with iron teeth in Daniel 7. We've got 10 toes or 10 kings in Daniel 2. And then in Daniel 7, we have these 10 horns that come out of that earlier part of the fourth kingdom. And then all of it terminated by God's kingdom, both visions and with the establishment of God's rule. Let's just quickly with these bullets just note the parallels. Both visions describe the rise and fall of four kingdoms. Both spend a disproportionate amount of time describing the fourth kingdom. Both visions hint that the fourth kingdom has two phases. And I've given you a review of that there. Both visions describe how the eternal kingdom of God will destroy and replace the fourth kingdom and all the kingdoms that came before it. And I believe, this last bullet's important, both visions imply that the second phase of that fourth kingdom hasn't appeared yet because it's terminated by the arrival of God's kingdom. Okay. That's where, you know, you almost feel forced, like, if I'm going to believe that these are accurate predictions about the future, there has to be a little bit of space, a little bit of time between the first part of the fourth kingdom, which I'm saying is the Rome of history, and the second phase, this 10-king confederacy that's maybe somehow related to it. Who is this little horn guy? We don't know yet. I don't have enough data here to launch off into speculation. So for now, I'll just say I'm not sure. How about this? He will be a leader who appears at the end of history, coming out from or among some kind of 10-king confederacy that may have historical or cultural ties to the old Roman Empire. How about that? That's about all I'd want to say right now. That's stretching it as it is. Let's just stay with that. Now, I've given you a little section describing what the fourth kingdom will be like. It's a loose confederacy somehow related to the first phase, terminated by God. All right, let's do Daniel 8. You guys okay? Huh? Okay. I appreciate your stamina here. All right. There are two beasts in chapter 8. Some very bizarre beasts. And these two beasts symbolize the second and third kingdoms in this sequence. So this one doesn't start with Babylon and it doesn't have four kingdoms. It starts with Medo-Persia, and there's only two kingdoms. So here's the vision, and again, I'll do vision interpretation all the way through. I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. Fortunately, in chapter 8, we're given exactly what we need, a precise identification. This ram, the one with the two horns, according to an angelic interpreter, represents the kings of Media and Persia. Oh, cool. All right, so we don't have to speculate. That's who it is. Again, spoken of as one entity. This was a coalition. It's interesting, too. The Medes were had the largest landmass and were more powerful at first in this coalition, but the Persians eventually became much more dominant. I mean, most of us, when we think about this empire in history, we think of it as the Achaemenid, I can't even say it. We think of it as the Persian Empire. We'll just put it that. You know that empire you saw in 300? Mm-hmm. That's these guys right here. Okay, so his point is, yeah, this visualization of the two horns, lopsided, you know, one longer than the other, a coalition of these two powers. You should start to appreciate this imagery. Turn the page real quick. Look at this chart. I put the chart in. I've included chapter 8. Now just think about this. A chest uniting two arms. Right? Then you've got, in Daniel 7, a bear raised up, a lopsided bear, one side larger than the other. Daniel 8, a ram with one horn longer than the other. And real clear identification that this particular kingdom is a coalition that has two main components. You see the parallelism here? You see the overlap in the imagery? I think that's pretty cool. Now, the third kingdom that's the symbol of the third kingdom is this goat. And this is another one that's clearly identified as Greece. He says, while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. So this is like a super fast goat, just like a hockey puck, just flying across the ice. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and he rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram. He was enraged at him, and he struck the ram, shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. And so he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. So you really have this animal coming in and blowing away, right? The goat blows away the ram. So one, they're not coincident. You know, one follows the other. It says, then the male goat, this is interesting language. The male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, it says, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Interesting. So right as he's at the zenith of his power, he's struck down, and his dominion is split four ways. If there's any question about what this is referring to, we get the answer. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. So there you go. The second vision here is referring to Greece. And he says the large horn, the one mentioned in what we just read, right here, that's between his eyes, is the first king. That large prominent horn is the first king. Get a commentary and look into this. Everybody agrees this is a reference to Alexander the Great, the prominent king of the Greek Empire that really saw its territorial expansion. Alexander became, he was allowed to control armies as a teenager. By age 22, he took 30,000 foot soldiers, like 7,000 cavalry, and swept across the known world and conquered it in 10 years. Think about a goat flying over the face of the earth. That's a really fitting image. I mean, that's exactly what Alex did. And you know what happened too is at the end of that campaign, he was a big drinker and he had happened to be sick, and he had two giant goblets of alcohol, totally passed out and lay in his bed dying. And this is the legend. We're not sure if it's true, but as he was passing away, his generals surrounded the bed, and they famously asked him, who's going to rule after you? And he said, give my kingdom to the strong. He didn't appoint a successor. And whether that's true or not, what is true is following Alexander the Great, there was a power struggle between power brokers in the Greek Empire, including his generals. And after it all shook out, four Greek kingdoms emerged. And they're right there in your notes at the bottom of the page. One led by Lysimachus, another one by Antipater. And the ones that are most important, if you're a student of Daniel, are Seleucus. He ruled out of Syria, and the Ptolemies, who ruled out of Egypt. I'm just telling you, this is a dead-on description, a prophetic description of Alexander the Great and his Greek Empire and what followed. There is an account in Josephus that when Alexander the Great rolled into Jerusalem, that the high priest, this is actually in Josephus. Now, some people have argued it was doctored up, but I don't know why we would have to conclude that. The high priest came out to Alexander the Great and showed him this text here in the book of Daniel. So I think it's kind of nifty. Now look at verse 22. The broken horn and the four horns that arose from its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation. That's exactly what I just said, although not with his power. And that's also true. That's why if you turn to the next page, when it does talk about one of the kings that was associated with one of these four kingdoms, he's called a small horn. Now, I've got a lot of text in here, and I'm not going to get into it. But this is for you to study on your own. But Daniel really geeks out on this small horn. Not like the little horn in chapter 7 that appears at the end of history. The small horn comes out of one of the Greek kingdoms, And again, this is not a controversial claim. The small horn is a guy named Antiochus IV Epiphanes. He was one of the descendants of Seleucid, or Seleucus, so he came out of that kingdom. And you can read a description of him. The thing to know about Antiochus was that he hated the Jews. He was the Adolf Hitler of the 2nd century B.C. He like burned Jews alive that circumcised their children, had them parade their babies around town, and then threw mothers tied to their babies over a cliff into the Kidron Valley. Hanukkah is a celebration of the overthrow of this guy. Okay, so this guy was really bad, and I think in many ways foreshadows, and I'll talk about this more in a little bit, a future ruler who would do similar things, a ruler who has not yet appeared. But anyhow, I don't have time to get into it. It's real fascinating. You can check it out. Let's go to Daniel 9. 70 weeks. Now, this is the prophecy of the 70 weeks. At the beginning of chapter 9, Daniel realizes that the Jews have been in exile for almost 70 years. And he knows from reading the book of Jeremiah that there's a prediction in Scripture that when the Jews went into exile, it would last 70 years. And so he's praying, God, what's next for your people? And in response to that prayer, the angel Gabriel is deputized, actually sent. This would be so cool. I'm praying, all of a sudden I see an angel to answer my prayer. Gabriel shows up and says, hey, here's what God has in store for your people. And it's all framed around this 70 weeks of events that happen. Now, here's the hard thing about it, is the word weeks, this is the a Hebrew word, Shabuah, and it's kind of a slippery word. You know how we have the word dozen, and that refers to a set of 12 items, like 12 eggs or whatever? A Shabuah is either a set of 7 days or a set of 7 years. It really depends on the context. And that's critical, because 70 weeks, if they're sets of 7 years, that's 490 years, right? But 70 weeks, if they're sets of 7 days, it's only 490 days. So how we read this prophecy has a lot to do with the way we interpret that word. I'm going to argue that he's thinking in terms of sets of 7 years. And most interpreters would agree, and here's why. First, there are plenty of places in the Bible where the word Shabuah refers to a set of 7 years. Remember the story about Laban and his two daughters, Rachel and Leah? You know, Rachel was really hot, and Leah was kind of not that much to look at. And Jacob falls in love with the younger daughter, Rachel, and this is what her dad has to say. He says to Jacob, it's not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. He's like, you can't marry Rachel. Leah, she's not married. And so he says, complete the week or the Shabuah of this one, and we'll give you the other also, the other being Rachel, for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years. So here, the week is 7 years. He says it again. Jacob did so. He worked for 7 years, right? He worked for her week, and he gave him his daughter, Rachel, as his wife. And indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. So here the Shabuah are sets of 7 years. Now, what about Daniel 9:24? How can we tell? Two ways to tell. One is, if you read what happens during the first 69 weeks of this prophecy, it's a pretty busy 69 weeks. Jerusalem is rebuilt, not just the city itself, but all of its defenses. That would take a long time. It says in John 2 that it took them 42 years just to build the temple. So the idea that, 69 times 7, that'd be 483 days. Rebuilding the whole city with its defenses in 483 days, it's not really enough time. Probably a more important consideration, though, is what's Daniel doing? He's thinking about the exile of Israel, how they're going to be in exile for 70 years. Why were they in exile? Because they failed to give the land its Sabbath rest. That was one of the big reasons. Every 7 years, every set of 7 years, the Jews were supposed to let the land lie fallow and not farm it. And they never did it. They never observed it. So think about it. 70 sets of 7 years, 490 years, they were in the land and they never let the land rest. And so God says, you will let the land rest. You will go into exile 1 year for every year you blew off the Sabbath. And you can read about this on the top of the next page. This is in 2 Chronicles. It says those Jews that escaped from the sword were carried away to Babylon. It's talking about the exile. And they were servants to Nebuchadnezzar and his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it kept the Sabbath until 70 years were complete. All this to say, the immediate context right prior to this vision is Daniel thinking in terms of sets of 7 years, not sets of 7 days. So the best way to take this week in Daniel 9:24 is to take it as a set of 7 years. Now, let's go back and actually read it. So you are to know and discern, he says, from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, there'll be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It'll be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Here's what's fascinated people for centuries about this passage, is this seems to give us a way to predict when in history the Messiah will come. Right? Look at the way I put it in your notes. From the decree until the Messiah, he says there's 7 Shabuah and 62 Shabuah. 69 sets of 7 years, or 483 years, between this decree, whatever that is, and the appearance of the Messiah. And so this is something people have been fascinated by for years. Now, the cool thing about the decree is there were several decrees issued about rebuilding Jerusalem, but the only one that included defenses was issued in 444 BC. It just so happens we can date that period of history accurately because the Persian kings were into astrology, right? So we can note the celestial events that they got into and correlate their observations with when this or that comet flew, or this or that supernova or whatever, and we're actually able to accurately date this period of history. 444 BC is the date of the decree, and I've given you a footnote if you want to geek out on that. The problem is, if it's 444, we can't just add 483 years to the number line. You can't do that. In other words, you'd think I could, think about it like a number line. Here's the decree. Oh, I'll just add 483 years, and then boom, I've got when the Messiah comes. Here's the problem. Years in prophetic literature in the Bible, and I've given you a footnote on this, are 360 days long. Sets 12 months of 30 days each. That's the way the Bible talks about years. They didn't have a modern solar calendar like we do. So you have to convert 483 years of 360 days per year to a solar year. So you got to multiply these two, and I did this in your notes, to get 177,880. Then you've got to divide it. You've got to divide that by the number of days in a solar year, right? So 177,880 or whatever it is. And that gives you this, 476.06, 476 solar years. We've got to use solar years because that 444 BC date is anchored in a solar calendar. It's a solar date. So we don't want to go negative 444 plus 483. We want to add 476. And if you do that, you get 32. That's what the answer. Negative 444 plus 476 is 32. Now remember, though, this is a number line. So it goes negative 1, 0, 1. But there's no 0 year on a timeline. That's not how it works. So to compensate, you have to bump down the timeline to 33. That's the year that this prophecy says the Messiah will appear. Now, I know Lycona said last night that his favorite date for the resurrection, I'm sorry, for the death and resurrection of Christ is 30. But I think 33 is actually a better date. Scholars are split over this. You can get a paper that Gary DeLashmit wrote on a guy named Segenus. If you go to our Xenos website and type this in, Segenus and the chronology of Christ, just put that in the search box and you'll get a very solid argument that 33 AD is the best date we have for the appearance of the Messiah. Either way, I mean, isn't it amazing that probably the most significant figure in human history, you know, the guy that our whole timeline revolves around, the guy that 2 billion people would kneel down to as their Lord, just happened to appear in history here in this window of time. I think that's pretty cool. And so in Daniel 9, what we have on your diagram there, you've got timeline 2, you got from this decree, 476 years forward gets you at 33 AD. All right, now, it's a prophecy of 70 weeks. That's just the first 69. Here's the weird thing about this prophecy. Right after the 69th week, it's like God presses the pause button, and there is a gap in time between the 69th and 70th week. So what you're about to read is after the 62 weeks, before the 70th week begins, because that starts in verse 27. He says, after the 62 weeks, in this intervening period, several important events happen. The Messiah will be cut off. Okay, this phrase, cut off, karat, that's used in Isaiah 53, verse 8, to describe how Jesus was cut off from the land of the living. It means it's sacrificial language describing something dying. Messiah comes and dies. Who's that? That's Jesus. 33 AD. This says the Messiah will show up and die in 33 AD and have nothing. Then it says the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Oh, now let me think about it. The city and the sanctuary. He's talking about Jerusalem and the temple being destroyed soon after the Messiah is killed. Now, who did that? Well, that's the Romans. They laid siege to Jerusalem in 66 A.D., and it fell in 70 A.D. The Emperor Titus did it. I got to go to Rome recently. I saw the arch the Romans built to celebrate this right here, the Romans destroying the city and the sanctuary. And its end comes with a flood. Even to the end, there'll be war. Desolations are determined. Interesting. The phrase, even to the end, there will be war. That evokes to me the idea that a stretch of time will go by, that time will pass. So this intervening period between the 69th and 70th week, you know, a lot's happening. Jesus talked about this period in Luke 21. He says, when you see Jerusalem, and he's referring to the fall of Jerusalem to the Roman Empire, he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, recognize her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea should flee to the mountains. Those who are in the midst of the city should leave. Those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things that are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be a great distress. And that's exactly right. So many people died when this happened. Upon the land and wrath to this people. And look what he says. Just think about what you know about history. He says that the city will be destroyed. It'll be terrible. The Jews will fall by the edge of the sword. They'll be led captive into all the nations. So he's saying the Jews will be scattered all over the place. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. So this really fits what we're reading about the middle between the 69th and 70th week, and there's a clear implication. Jerusalem will be occupied by other nations for a while until this period is fulfilled. What's that suggest? They'll be back again at some point. All right, so Turning the page here, let's talk about the 70th week, because it's dominated by a figure called the Prince Who Is to Come, a figure who is very similar to this little horn in Daniel 7. It says this Prince Who Is to Come, that's the he here, he'll make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he'll put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. All right, several things to talk about here. First, he says this happens at the end. Where is that? I must have picked that up from a different verse. I guess I got a little confused on that. A couple things he says here. He's a prince. That was back in verse 26. So he's a prince of a leader of some kind. If you look in this language back here, he's from the people who are to come. The people, the prince who is to come, those people are the Romans. So this guy is somehow connected to the Roman Empire. Another thing it mentions is that he's going to commit something called the abomination of desolation. That's toward the end of verse 27. Right? Let me get to verse 27. On the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. Those are technical terms. An abomination is an offense to God. A desolation is just rendering something ceremonially useless. And it's saying that he does something. He goes in to the temple to do something that's really destructive. We saw this with Antiochus Epiphanes. When he was alive, he slaughtered a pig and poured its juice all over the altar. They called it back then an abomination of desolation. All right, let's see if we can connect all this with the other visions in Daniel. So look at this table 5, right? So you've got the head of gold, the winged lion, and so on. Notice first that the small horn in row 3 appears before the Messiah. See that? You've got that small horn that's connected to Greece. That's happening well before Jesus ever lived. But then the prince who is to come, that's after the gap of time, after Messiah's cut off, Jerusalem is destroyed, and that period of, even to the end, war and desolation is determined. This prince who is to come appears at the end of history during the 70th week. And just like we saw in Daniel chapter 2 and 7, this vision, if you go all the way back to verse 24, this vision is terminated by everlasting righteousness. Again, when this is all over, God's kingdom comes in. So similar, definitely a similar pattern to what we saw in chapter 2 and in chapter 7. One last thing to note about this. Notice that the little horn and this prince who is to come appear at the same period of history, right before God's kingdom is established. Both are hostile to God's people. Both disrupt Jewish religious practices. And the other thing I would say about both these guys is they match descriptions in the New Testament of the Antichrist to a T. You can read these on your own because we don't have time, but look at 2 Thessalonians 2. It describes how the Antichrist will commit an abomination of desolation in the temple. Revelation 13 describes how the Antichrist will persecute God's people. And so what should we be looking for if we're trying to figure this out? Like, are we near the end of history? We need to look for something that Jesus told us to look for. If we're trying to go, is this the Antichrist? Is God's kingdom about to come? We need to look for the abomination of desolation. That's what Jesus told us to do. That is the signature sign that we're in this phase of history. Let's read what Jesus says. He says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, standing in the temple, let the reader understand. He says, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. And he goes on to describe a great tribulation leading up to the return of Christ. So these are events at the end of history, and he's saying the you know what hits the fan when you see this person enter the temple and commit this act. And here's an intriguing statement. He says, let the reader understand. If you're reading Daniel, he says, be careful. Why would he say that? Well, I think it's because there are two abominations in Daniel. There's the one that Antiochus the IV did. You can read about that in chapter 8 and in chapter 11. And then there's the one that the prince who is to come, the future ruler, the Antichrist, will do at the end of history in chapter 9. He's saying it's that latter abomination to look for. He's like, read carefully. Okay. Look at these timelines. Hopefully this will help. I know this is like a wall of words, but so just looking at Daniel, you've got the decree, then the Messiah appearing and being killed, the destruction of Jerusalem, a gap in time, then the 70th week dominated by a prince who is to come, who commits an abomination of desolation. He meets his end, and then we have the establishment of everlasting righteousness. That's what Daniel 9 says. That is the timeline from Daniel 9. Now I'm taking that same timeline and I'm just adding in content from the visions in the earlier part of Daniel. Right? So I've just got the kingdoms, Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, and Antiochus is part of that Greek kingdom, and then Rome. Again, the Messiah cut off a gap in time, the appearance of the 70th week, right? And again, this last part of history, according to Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, there's a 10-toe, 10-horn, 10-king confederacy, and there's this little horn that comes up among it that hates God and persecutes his people. I'm saying that little horn is the Antichrist, the prince who is to come of Daniel 9. He's the one that commits the abomination of desolation. That's the guy that we should look for. That's it. So you can see we've covered some of our bases. You can see, yeah, there really are some different characteristics of these two phases. And if you look at all these timelines together, there is evidence for a gap in time. There really is. Daniel 9 implies a big gap in time. All right, and lastly, I'm going to not lecture on the Daniel 11 part. I just don't have time. But just suffice it to say, it references Antiochus being confronted by the Romans, a fleet of ships from Katim. And we have a historical reference from a historian named Livy, who makes it very clear. He describes this prophecy in Daniel 11. And it's Roman power basically displacing Greek power. Daniel describes Rome as the empire that does follow Greece. So that's how you can strengthen that fourth kingdom. All right, now, a couple mistakes. One big mistake here would be to stick with the screw the details thing. Or this, so what? It's never going to happen. Really? I mean, they were saying in the 1950s there's going to be flying cars and all kinds of crazy stuff. None of that's come to pass. What has come to pass is this broad outline of history. It has occurred just like the Bible describes, to great detail. And that ought to pique our interest in staying on top of what the Bible says about the future. It's already what we know has come true. Why wouldn't we take what's left to come true seriously? We don't want to go around saying the Antichrist is this person or that. You can get online. There's so many different YouTube videos about who the Antichrist is. I mean, think about how easily you could be duped. What if you were alive during World War II, right? And Hitler's consolidating Europe, which has ancient ties to Rome. And, you know, and he's trying to form these nations into one empire. And, you know, he's persecuting the Jews. And wouldn't it be easy to think that's the guy? It's easy to get deceived here. We got to stick to Jesus' sign, which is the abomination of desolation. That's when it's time to, take note. Other than that, we got to be careful not to jump to a conclusion. Christ is coming back tomorrow, and I'm freaking out. You know, I think my money is on he is coming back very soon. A lot of the geopolitical things are in place for something like I've described to happen. I'm not going to geek out and speculate, is this the G8 or all? That's, I don't know. I just know that we should stick to really being aware this is the kind of the fabric and the framework that the Bible lays out for the end of history. These are the key events to look for. If you get nervous about this kind of thing, just remember John 16. Jesus says, I lay these things out so that you can have peace. Right? In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, I've overcome the world. So I don't know what you're facing or what's knocked you off balance recently, but if anything, you should be comforted by the fact that your God's on top of things, just like he is obviously here. So I would just send you away urging you, don't ignore this type of prophecy. This is part of the Bible. God wants you to study really hard. And I know this is an example of doing that, but this is what he wants. And the other thing is, I hope, like if I've looked at this as I study it, you just get this settled sense, like, holy crap. Like, this isn't just a great worldview. This is true. And it just makes you want to sell out and leave it on the floor for God. I mean, he's real. I can't think of anything more important than bringing people into a relationship with the God who's revealed this to us. So, okay. Now, I know a lot of, I'll pray for us. Feel free to split if you want to have questions. I'll stick around and talk. Thanks for your patience. I know that was way too much talking. I don't know how else to get it all in, though. So, all right, Lord, just thanks for everybody's graciously hanging in there. I pray we'd go back through this on our own. One talk will never persuade anybody. It takes a while to get this. And I pray that everyone here would really master this info and be able to absorb it and believe it for themselves. And I thank you, too, like we said earlier, that you love us enough to not leave us in the dark about the future, but to give us a glimpse into what to look for, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.